I want to eventually get to a description of work that Crooked Bardacci and I initiated about 3 years ago, which was partly inspired by the ADS-CFT connection, where we take the planar diagrams of some field theory, and we are not particularly restricted to just thinking about gauge theories, but planar diagrams indicate that it's some kind of a matrix theory, so we can take a large n limit, and construct a world sheet system that, if you could solve the world sheet system, it would sum the planar diagrams for you. But I want to start by way of introduction and also as some review with some work that various people have done involving partial summations of graphs, like ladder graphs and Bethe-Salpeter equations. In particular, I want to focus on a result from ADS-CFT, which discusses the solution. This is the boundary of a string that's suspended from the boundary, goes into ADS and comes back, and ask to what extent that can be understood by partial graph summation. So the known results are, first of all, the ground state configuration has an energy, which is 2 times the quark mass. I mean, effectively, the quark mass is taken to be infinity since we're pinning the points at the boundary. And then the famous result of Maldacena is root lambda over L. This is a strong coupling result, 2 pi cubed over gamma of 1/4 to the 4th. Where now, this lambda, I think, disagrees with almost everyone else's lambda. It's the one I've been using for quite a while. It's NC alpha S over 2 pi. And to avoid confusions about coupling constants, because there are factors of square roots of 2 that occur depending on whether you use 1/4 trace F squared or sum over A F A squared as your kinetic energy, that alpha S is the conventional QCD alpha S, the one that is 0.11 something at the Z mass. So this includes a factor of NC, which is the appropriative Tuft combination, and it also includes a factor of pi, which always comes with radiative corrections, and an extra factor of 2 for just to get rid of factors of 2 somewhere else in the equations. So without the 2, this coupling constant is a fair measure of the size of radiative corrections. We really do get an extra pi in radiative corrections. We do have to pay this price of NC, and then alpha S is the strong coupling analog of the fine structure constant. Now, there's more to this system than just the energy, because as Cowan and I won't pronounce this right, Guillosa calculated some time ago, like 6 years ago, you can wiggle this string. There are small oscillations that you can compute in the semi-classical approximation, and I want to summarize their results by drawing an energy level diagram, which is sort of a target for graph summation techniques. That is, we would like to understand this system together with its excitations from the point of view of summing graphs rather than from the point of view of ADS. So the energy level diagram will have, let me put the zero axis up a little. There's a continuum. Which starts at 2 times the quark mass. This energy sits down here. Let me call this the ground state energy of the system. And that's the strong coupling evaluation of the ground state energy. And then when you do small oscillations, or when more precisely when Callan and Guillosa do small oscillations, they conclude that this gap between the ground state and the continuum is populated by discrete levels. And in the semi-classical approximation, these discrete levels are characterized by a set of frequencies omega n, which satisfy some transcendental equation involving an elliptic integral. And an n, so these omega n's are like the modes of a string. So characteristic of the vibrations of a string, there are many oscillator modes, not just a single oscillator mode.
These are just the bosonic fluctuations?
These are just the bosonic fluctuations. They didn't do a complete, they didn't oscillate in all dimensions of ADS, but just in the ADS directions. I mean, all the different directions of oscillation are separable from one another in the small oscillation regime. And they just focused on this one. I mean, so there are certainly, first of all, I haven't told you any details of this, so I've just drawn a bunch of discrete levels. But beyond the ones that they computed, there are also vibrations in the S5 and in the other directions, and in the fermionic directions. So I'm not trying to give you a precise statement of what the result is, but just I want to emphasize that there is a gap between the ground state and the continuum, and the gap is populated with discrete levels, presumably all the way up, although the small oscillation calculations only gets them down here. This frequency, as I said, is a solution of some elliptic integral equation. Some elliptic integral equals some multiple of pi. But to a very good approximation, it's just n plus 1 over L times 2 pi cubed over gamma of a quarter to the fourth.
Yeah, this is the oscillation in the radial direction, even in ADS.
So we've only done transverse. That's correct. These are only the transverse. So it's a selected set of oscillations. We can be assured that there are many more, but I'm not really concentrating on the details of the spectrum. So, I mean, they're discrete levels in any case. But the ones that are characterized by this frequency are specifically the transverse ones. The other ones are presumably similar frequencies, but won't be precisely that because the boundary conditions will be slightly different. So it's not a linear relationship of n to frequency, but it's practically linear. It gets better and better. This is a large n approximation. This is the asymptote to the frequency versus n curve. And at the lowest value, the lowest value is n equals 1 in the way I'm enumerating things. At the lowest value, it's the exact answer is 10% below the asymptotic value, and it gets better and better as you go higher. So it's a pretty good approximation all the way up. Okay, so this summarizes the large lambda limit as obtained from ADS. So string in ADS, you have the Maldacena solution plus the Calandriosa solutions for small oscillations. And the qualitative physical system here is a ground state, a gap, a continuum, and discrete levels populating the gap. Now, if we're going to do graph summation, we're going to start at lambda equals 0, which is the opposite end of the spectrum. So we need to discuss the lambda goes to 0 limit of this system. And the lambda goes to 0 limit of the system is, of course, well known. There's a continuum and a gap and a single discrete level, which is basically the Coulomb. Let's see, in my units, it's minus pi lambda over L. So there's a discrete level, a gap, and a continuum, but the gap is not populated by discrete levels. Okay, are there any questions about this? So these are the two limits, weak coupling and strong coupling of this particular system. So I focus on a particular system to sort of as a target or a challenge for our graph summation methods. Yeah, Kobe.
Strong coupling computation should be also related to the computation of the Lucier term, right? In some way,
Well, the Lucier term would be, so I haven't tried to compute the sum over omegas. The Lucier term would be buried in there. So, of course, there's a zero-point energy to the fluctuation. I mean, when you do a small oscillation, you correct the ground state by a sum of the frequencies of the zero-point oscillations. I haven't attempted to compute that. Arkady, I think, has computed that, and with David, you two have computed this quantity. That serves to correct the ground state energy, But what I'm focusing on are the qualitative spectrum of the system, which is a ground state, discrete levels, and a continuum. Well, the frequencies won't be identical, probably. I mean, since we haven't been computed, well, I guess one doesn't know for sure. But it should be finite, as Arkady was telling me. Or will, you've proved it to be finite.
It's finite for any whatever, it's conformal signal.
This gap surprised me. I mean, I was a little bit, because it's a gapless theory, after all. There is no, the glue balls don't have, I mean, don't have a mass. You have a fixed L, but still there are zero mass gluon states that can be tacked on to that. No, I mean, so as NC goes to infinity, the zero mass glue ball states decouple. But at finite N, there would not be a gap here. That's an important, I mean, that's an important thing to appreciate, that it came out in discussions with Juan and Igor when I was in Princeton. That, I mean, here it's obvious because, or at least obvious from string intuition, because as N goes to infinity, the only way this system can decay is through emission of glue balls or closed strings or something like that. And those are suppressed by 1 over N factors. It's interesting that the larger, the sort of the planar approximation all by itself implies that this gap is not populated by anything that can couple to that system. And I can explain that if there are any questions.
But the only reason you were initially surprised is that one tends to think of the system without restricting yourself to the single sector.
Right.
Many people think of students and the zero couple limit consisting of lots of free drawings.
Right.
Right.
Although, I mean, since you don't have confinement, non-singlet gluons can go off to infinity. They can only go off to infinity by paying that grep. Well, that's true. That's true.
Now, if you were to work in a bigger Hilbert space of colored states,
well, that's, you know, certainly they come all the way down to here. But they don't couple to the system. That's the point. They don't couple to the planar approximation.
And that's true, but you need two things, don't you? Both Gauss's law.
Yeah. Well, I think we're in agreement. I hope and think we are in agreement, David. So now you can actually get a physicist's interpolation between these two diagrams, because discrete levels are like bound states. Here you have a single bound state. What happens is the coupling increases. What is the natural thing to assume? The gap increases, and then as the coupling gets bigger and bigger, more and more levels, bound state levels, should become available and start populating the gap, and eventually, and, sorry, what? As lambda goes to infinity? What do you mean it decreases? Lambda goes to infinity, it deepens. Well, at least it starts to deepen at lambda equals zero. It's continuing to deepen at lambda equals infinity, because this is the square root of lambda, and I assume, I mean, unless something really spectacular happens, it's going to continue to deepen as you increase the coupling. So I don't think there's any doubt about what we want to do if we can sum graphs. We would like to sum graphs to link this picture at weak coupling to that picture at strong coupling, and we don't expect anything spectacular to happen in the process of going from weak to strong coupling. It's more or less, I mean, since we know the strong coupling from ADS, we know the weak coupling from perturbation theory, we are fairly confident that what has to happen in between is more and more levels have to come in, and eventually the gap goes to infinity, but that's not a wildly unconventional thing to try to explain.
Wouldn't you need a scale to get the first level within
No.
There has to be a point in
lambda. No, all of these levels, I should say, all of these levels are set by L. So these are numbers divided by L. See, I put the frequency here. So you don't need a new scale, you just need more power in the coupling.
Yeah,
It's guaranteed by conformal.
Well, of course, yeah, we're dealing with a conformal theory. In fact, I want to stress that this is a feature of the conformal theory. It's not something that involves putting a Strassler floor in ADS at all. There are strings, therefore, real, honest-to-goodness strings with excitations that are motored by omega n that are to be explained in the conformal theory. Now, let me, before going to the stuff that Corkett and I did, let me review some work by Erickson, Semenov, Szabo, and Zarembo, who tried to attack this problem of getting ADS from just simply summing ladder diagrams. Now, of course, ladder diagrams are certainly planar, but ladder diagrams are a very tiny fraction of the full set of planar diagrams. And so you would a priori expect this to be fine for weak coupling, but perhaps a disaster for strong coupling. Now, it's interesting that it can be, depending on your gauge choice, this is not a gauge invariant set of diagrams. In fact, so depending on your gauge choice, you can get almost any result you can imagine. But sort of the simplest gauge choice that they chose, so this is Erickson, Semenov, and Zarembo, was just Lorentz gauge. These are just fixed sources. So the Beta-Salpeter equation is just a one-dimensional differential or integral equation. And when the dust settles after deriving it, the differential equation that is the Beta-Salpeter equation is just a one-dimensional quantum system, which I will write down here, and then we will discuss. So this is T is the relative time in the Beta-Salpeter equation. G of T is just the Green's function for the two sources. And this is just the kernel for the photon exchange. And it comes out in terms of the energy squared. With a negative sign there, because it's an attractive potential. And of course, we know, I mean, anyone that, we all know that this one-dimensional quantum system is very easy to sort of qualitatively analyze. First of all one-dimensional attractive potentials form at least one bound state. That's this guy. At very weak coupling, that's all you get, just that one bound state. As you increase coupling, you have the possibility of creating more and more bound states, which would begin to populate the levels we're shooting for over here. Now, this system is actually related to a famous system. If I didn't have the L, it's just lambda over T squared. And it's well known that that potential has a critical coupling of 1/4. The first discrete level I could have has to be odd in parity, and therefore it must vanish at the origin. That's the same problem as the radial Schrodinger equation problem with 1 over r squared potential at very large t compared to L. Below this critical coupling, there's nothing new. Above, and no matter how small above that critical coupling, there are an infinite number of discrete levels. That's basically because the system, when lambda is bigger than 1/4, this is the thing that's analyzed in Einstein Lifshitz, and they tell you there's the fall, the collapse of the system to a point. There's basically a continuum of levels from minus infinity to infinity in the system. There's no bottom to the kinetic energy, which is 1/T² by the uncertainty principle, at lambda bigger than 1/4 can't compete with the potential energy, and the whole system collapses to a point. The presence of L stops that collapse, but it doesn't prevent the fact that there is so near lambda equals 1/4, what do we have? Well, we haven't changed the fact that we have a continuum. We haven't changed the fact that we have a ground state, although we don't know the formula for it. It's some whatever it is. And there are some levels, and they pile up. There's an accumulation point of levels near threshold, which, let's see if I even had a formula for it, if you're interested. Where's my formula? It's an exponential pileup. So the binding energy, the distance from, let me call B minus E. And B, let's imagine that I have computed one level in the regime where B is very, very small compared to 1. Then the other levels, an infinite number of other levels, are spaced according to the square root of lambda minus 1/4. I think there's a pi here, too. So you get a whole lot at lambda equals 1/4. You have to take this with a grain of salt. I mean, of course, in the detail, the fact that there's an accumulation of levels here, just a feature of this potential. The exact sum of planar diagrams is certainly not going to be this equation. This is just a very tiny subset. This is just the gluons and nothing more. So I wasn't even necessarily targeting ADS-CFT. I was just targeting weak coupling gauge theory. So in fact, I'm particularly interested only in the gluon case because I'm interested in pure QCD, but it's the same approximation whatever you take. The important thing is that the vector particles are important because the coupling here is proportional to the energy. And since these are infinitely massive fixed sources, you need that factor of m.
The component variance and the finiteness of the theory come from delicate cancellations between the vectors and the scalars.
Right.
So I'm wondering whether those into account.
You mean the levels would go away?
Well, no, it's a very simple modification of the problem.
I was just thinking about that just as you asked the question. I mean, you don't get the factor of energy here for the scalar coupling. I think the vector coupling is important because these are effectively taken.
You get the vector, you don't get the velocity particle, you get the absolute value of the velocity.
For scalar couplings? I thought it was just a constant.
Come on, actually. So the conforming rank theory, is it?
I think that the scalars are here. It's just that it gives you a different factor of the half or something.
Well, there's a quartic. There must be a quartic coupling or something.
No, there's a linear coupling. The Wilson loop that you're discussing is the Wilson loop that has a scalar. Is a n equals 4 Wilson loop. It's not just all these things.
Well, in any case, I'm not including them. Okay, so all I'm doing is the latter sum with gluons.
Could those cancel to the quantum?
Well, he's suggesting they might cancel, I think.
Yeah, that's what makes the theory fine. Remove all the ultraviolet degrees.
But this is not an ultraviolet issue. I mean, these planar diagrams, I mean, these ladder diagrams are perfectly finite. They're not. I suspect that this is the first glimmering of that. And besides, it's not all that unreasonable. I mean, I'm certainly not arguing that this is a good approximation to anything, because
to make it, let me put it a different way. These are related in the gauge theory by gauge invariants to the term which has a quarter coupling, which is an ultraviolet infinite. Unless you, there's a compact term. You really have.
Well, there's lots of terms, including terms like this.
On the same line, you can have two gluons come together in a bubble, which is divergent, and that's canceled by the scalar piece. So,
let's.
It's easy enough to include it, which is without the.
Within the latter approximation.
And it's certainly something in the theory.
Yeah, sure. Well, in the ADS theory, yeah. If we're interested in QCD.
Look, everything you're dealing with relies heavily on conformal invariants. The reason we're getting the 1 over t squared, which is giving you this thing, is a consequence of conformal invariants.
Right.
But the conformal invariants will only come if you have the scalars there.
That's right.
So, for the minute, at least one step closer.
Well, okay, I don't think you're well, one tiny step. If they canceled, that would be surprising.
If they made a difference.
Is there a
way to do this semi calculation and get the solution of the gauge?
It's a very good question. Nobody has ever done it, and it's tricky because it's no longer GPS.
Can I?
A single line.
Okay. The only thing further I want to say. I mean, this is just quoting. Actually, I mean, this equation I took out of Erickson and Semenov. So I think they were only gluons that they included. But on the other hand, they included other. I mean, when they did the circular one with you, or along, you know, independently with you, they did include more than just
the circular one. We believe you could do exactly the laws and everything. But you definitely need to do that supersymmetrically.
Right.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be conformally invariant at the very least.
Right. But anyway, this is a conformally invariant set of diagrams, certainly.
No.
Yes.
Well, not conformally invariant.
It's not gauge invariant. Scale invariant. Okay.
But anyway, it's not gauge invariant.
So. But what would certainly be easy to do is to just add on the scalar exchange. If you change the topology of the diagram, it immediately gets to a more complicated thing. I mean, you certainly want to change. We eventually want to sum over all planar diagrams. So it would be just a change of this coupling constant to do the exchange, and then to do other topologies.
That's what I'm asking you about. As there are in all the usual graphs and surveying else, the reasons of how you get the theory to be fine. So it could be that this, you know, there's actually, I don't know either.
I did not include the scalars. So this is a result for pure Yang-Mills, if you will. I think it's already interesting for pure Yang-Mills. And the only other thing I wanted to say was that there is a translation, of course, between lambda c equals a quarter. This extra structure of levels comes in at not too wildly a strong coupling constant. I like to actually not include the 2 here and say that nc alpha s over pi is a fair measure of radiative corrections. So that particular measure is about a half. No, nothing to do with non-abelian theory. This is just ladder approximation. What?
You have this, it doesn't allow cross runs.
It's planar.
So it's planar.
Well, some planar.
Well, no, let me.
Graphs in this order in QED because you.
Well, it's not all the graphs in any theory. Let me remind people about QED. Let me remind people about QED. In QED, this ladder sum is the same. There's no difference. In QED, if you sum cross ladders, all ladders, you don't get any of this structure at all. You just get lambda over L, full stop. There's nothing more.
That's exactly why that's why I brought it up, because I'm questioning the validity of this concept.
Or it's gauge dependent also, right? In this calculation, if I do it, the reason I'm bringing this up is that a fairly benign sum of graphs reflects qualitatively a strong coupling answer. I'm not saying that this is the answer. I'm just suggesting.
Let me ask it differently.
Okay.
If I do the same calculation in a general gauge, not Lorentz gauge, with an alpha parameter, it would be trivial. Is the behavior the same?
In Coulomb gauge, it certainly isn't. Because in Coulomb gauge, it's just like the sum of cross ladders in QED. It's not a gauge. This is a highly gauge variant, gauge non-independent conclusion. I'm not trying to draw a conclusion about the theory. That's the challenge. The challenge is to sum all the planar graphs, not these. The point of this, and I guess it's probably maybe a mistake to bring it up, the point of this is to say that, is to show that a fairly benign set of graphs that we are used to trying to solve in field theory for years displays the kind of features that we're aiming for, so that we don't have to expect wildly different phenomena to come from a wildly different sum of graphs. But I want to sum all the graphs, of course. And that was meant to be an introduction to the stuff that Corkin and I are doing, which is to sum all the graphs. But we're not going to sum all the graphs either. We're just going to present an algorithm for mapping the sum of planar graphs onto a world sheet system, which itself will be hard to solve. Not meant to be easy. This was supposed to be a little provocative and to maybe challenge people.
The features are something like a match.
What?
Features that match are just these energy levels that accumulate near zero, or also these.
No, no, I don't know. I don't know. This is something that can be done over here, I suppose. I don't know how the energy levels behave up here near threshold.
Probably they also accumulate, but I don't know if they do so exponentially
or not. No, that's certainly not a detail I expect to. In fact, none of the details would I expect. What I said from the very beginning was, what I said from the very beginning is, we have a weak coupling. You don't know. No one's done this calculation, I don't think.
You know, for large n, they don't
accumulate. Look, let's not talk about a calculation that hasn't been done. Okay, if I could call time out for the discussion, I can get to the main part of my talk. And David is leaving.
I told you.
What?
Just a conceptual question. You know that there are these different modes associated with different directions of oscillation.
Which I didn't,
How does it come in here?
Well, I mean, roughly, it doesn't come in. Well, okay, for different directions, it will come in with other possible exchanges, perhaps. There are other quantum numbers. But the real structure that one's trying to reproduce is not so much that trivial multiplicity, you know, there's 5 or 6 or however more, 20, a factor of 20 more levels that come from that. The real structure that is the target of the investigation is to get stringy modes, an infinite number of oscillators. Because this sort of system that I've described here, one feature that is not the same as the target is that it's basically the levels of a single one-dimensional system. So more like one oscillator alone rather than an infinite number of oscillators. So I would, of course, if you start drawing all planar diagrams, you see how structure can be put into this system that could maybe vibrate and oscillate like a string. So the idea here is that the ladder sum was only just a hint of something that could probably, hopefully, will happen. When you sum all of the planar graphs, you will get not only just the sort of, you will get a richer structure. David was worrying about all this stuff canceling or something if you included everything. I think the more likely possibility is that the structure of levels gets richer as you include other things, and then of course getting hopefully the infinite number of oscillators of a string. Okay, so how can we do better? One could focus on this fact that this critical coupling is not so terribly large to try to do better by introducing corrections to the ingredients of the beta saltpeter equation. You know, correct the propagator, correct the kernel, correct, but do that gradually, order by order, and then maybe you would learn more about what's going on at this critical value. It's not so wildly large that is totally hopeless. But apart from that, I think basically the only thing we have is to do the whole sum and not just stop with ladders. Ladders and corrections to ladders may help illuminate what's going on at this critical value of the coupling, but it's certainly not going to help us understand the passage all the way to lambda equals infinity. We're going to have to do the whole thing, and that's what was motivating Corkert and me to try to map, not solve it, not sit down and solve it, but rather map the sum of planar diagrams onto a system it has some hope of being solved. Okay, any questions? So let me describe in the remainder of my talk, remainder of my time, the setup that Korkut and I have constructed. Korkut will be here one more week. I'm leaving on Saturday, but if there is interest in further discussion, I'm sure he would be happy to hold some discussion sections.
This one may be completely misleading because it's gauge dependent.
Well, yeah, I mean, in one gauge, there's nothing, right? In Coulomb gauge, it's just like QED. In Lorentz gauge, you have all this structure, including the square root of lambda at large coupling. In Lightcone gauge, you have a similar structure, but it's a little bit different. And clearly, it's not meant to be taken seriously. What I intended it for was a tantalizing hint that the sum of graphs is not a hopeless proposition, which I think it's inclined to be dismissed as. Okay, so we're not going to try to sum all the diagrams of QCD. We're going to try to sum the planar diagrams of QCD. Now, as background, let me draw, again, with fixed sources, just to focus on something concrete, draw a fairly complicated planar diagram that's by far not a ladder. And it'll put a self-energy somewhere, maybe even have an extra gluon in the initial state. These are the kinds of graphs we want to sum. Now, for a long time, way back in the early days of dual models, people were thinking about the world sheet that came from string theory as an approximation of very large planar diagrams. And you can sort of visually at least see that. The planar diagrams can be thought of as a mapping of a set of points, which are the vertices of the diagram, into target space. Integrating over all the vertices is a rough, coarse lattice representation of the sort of thing we do in string theory. We have a mapping of parameter space, and I'm just going to use the parameter space as parameterized on Lightcone. We have a mapping of parameter space into target space. And we integrate over all possible configurations of X as a function of sigma and tau, corresponding to the sum, to the integration over all locations of the vertices. Now, in the old days, it was pretty clear, it seemed obvious, that at best, this idea is only a rough approximation. Because how could it be that a graph with only a few vertices in any way can be properly thought of as a sheet, as a surface? Because that's basically what is happening when you go from an integration over a few vertex points to an integration over an arbitrary history of a string. You're increasing the number of points to infinity, a continuous infinity labeled on. The planarity of the graphs gives you at least an ordering of points around a plane. But the density of points for small graphs is obviously very, very, is in nowhere near like a continuous manifold. So for a long time, and so from that old idea, it was presented as a potential approximation. String theory is an approximation to a sum of huge, they call them fishnet graphs. But no one seriously thought that somehow this sigma tau representation could be an exact representation of the sum of all graphs. Because little graphs with few vertices don't look much like, they just have a couple of points, don't look much like a surface. And that's what basically ADS CFT, that pessimistic outlook is what ADS CFT correspondence upended. And now we believe, at least in some cases, and maybe more generically, this is in fact a way of exactly representing the sum of planar graphs. Now, if in the absence of symmetry arguments that tell you what theory a given string theory would correspond to, all right, Corkerton, my idea is, well, let's look at these graphs and see if we can map them directly onto a worldsheet system. Now, let me start. See, I want to try to draw just take a relatively simple but not totally trivial graph here that has elements of, you know, it has a self-energy insertion, it has a vertex correction, it has a box, it has sort of the elements of the most general graph, but it's not so terribly complicated that what I draw is going to be so just mind-numbingly complicated. Let's just look at this graph. Now, there was a way of drawing that graph that's in Atuf's original paper back in 1974, which makes it look a lot like a world sheet. You map lines of the graph onto strips of the world sheet, and vertices are just places where strips join. So if I've done this properly, I'm going to try to draw the corresponding Atuf diagram, which is patterned after the Mandelstam light cone string diagrams, that corresponds to that one. Okay, so now let me see what I have here. We have two particles in the final state, two particles in the initial state. So these two strips are pictorial representations of those two incoming lines. Okay, there is a separation of strips here, which is represented by, let me get this right, a long vertical line. Let's see, this doesn't come all the way. Oh, it does, okay. A long vertical line like so. This self-energy correction is a small vertical line in the middle of that strip. This vertex correction is a small vertical line that overlaps this interaction point and that. And I think, let's see, we got the right number of loops. One, two, this is a three-loop diagram. One, two, we have three loops in the representation. So this is a pictorial triumph in mapping the diagram onto a strip, although the meaning of these strips doesn't look much like what we think of as a world sheet representation of a string, but nonetheless, you drew these diagrams. All the action is where these lines are. So in this way of drawing the diagram, we have a basic rectangular world sheet, if you will, and the action of the dynamics looks like it's very benign compared to the overall bulk size of the world sheet. It's just occurring on these vertical boundaries that can appear and disappear as we sum over all diagrams. So when we sum over all diagrams, we're summing over all different ways of putting these vertical lines on this rectangular world sheet with appropriate coupling constants every time a line appears or disappears. And we're not only summing over all different, well, summing over all different lines includes summing over all different locations of these strips, sizes and lengths of those strips on the world sheet. So right away we are replacing the idea of summing over graphs, individual graphs, with some drama that is taking place on the world sheet. And the drama is just the appearance or disappearance of vertical lines. Now, how can we keep track of that drama of the appearance and disappearance of vertical lines? Well, they're always vertical. The reason is, this is a light cone world sheet, so it's P plus. This is an evolution time like so. P plus is conserved. So that means that the width of a strip is conserved. So all of these strips have to keep the same width as they evolve. They can break apart into two strips or join into a single bigger strip, but the overall width, the statement of P plus conservation is just the statement that all of these widths are conserved. So therefore, the only thing that's happening in a diagram is that these lines are going, appearing and disappearing.
Something at this point, you have a one-to-one translation.
Uh-huh.
You can give me this picture and I draw you the diagram.
Right.
In what sense do you hope to?
Well, that's the punchline, so to speak. I mean, I'm not going to get too far in this discussion, but I hope at least to explain that. At the moment, I just accept my pictures, or a TUF's pictures, to be more precise.
These lines in the horizontal direction is arbitrary.
You have to integrate over that, because that represents the loop momentum P plus. Okay, something else. The way we're going to put target space information onto this diagram, well, part of it is in the shape of the world sheet itself. The P plus target information is put in by the widths of the strips. The time, evolution time, that's X plus, by the way. We're unabashedly light cone here. The time is put in by the length, the overall length of the strips. And the time of individual virtual lines is just the length of the extra line that has appeared and disappeared. What about the transverse information? We've taken care of the X plus and the P plus information. That's basically X plus and X minus. What about the transverse coordinates? Well, this is also in a TUF's paper. He uses a dual way of assigning momentum to the planar diagram. So instead of assigning momentum to individual lines, he associates momentum, and this is transverse momentum, by the way, to all the faces of the diagram. And we also associate external momenta with regions between lines. So there's K0, K1. These are external momenta, K2, K3. Then the actual momentum carried by any line is the difference of two Qs. Okay, that's the actual transverse momentum carried by the line. And momentum conservation is manifest because in this dual representation, the momentum is conserved because whenever two strips join, the common Q cancels. And you have the difference between the... Okay, so on this diagram, these lines are associated with momenta. So we have Q1, Q2, Q3. And here we have K1 associated with this line that goes off to infinity, and K2 that is associated with that line that goes off to infinity in that direction. And then we have also some external momenta, Q0 and Q, no, by this time it's 3, or K0 and K3 that account for the overall momentum fed into the system from below. So the overall momentum is K3 minus K0. The individual virtual momenta are the various QIs. So anytime you have two parallel lines, there's a propagator there with carrying momentum Q1 minus Q2. Or there's a propagator here carrying momentum Q1 minus Q3. Or here carrying K1 minus Q2. Okay? So now, if you've bought the pictures, it's great, right? And at the level of drawing pictures, we have mapped the sum of diagrams onto a statistical system. What is the nature of this statistical system?
Charles, yeah. There's a question there about the quartic coupling.
This formalism only works with cubic couplings. Actually, you could probably find a way to do quartics, but we don't need to, actually, it turns out, because quartic couplings will come out automatically. This is one of the nice things about the formalism. The gauge quartic couplings come out automatically as soon as you put in the cubic ones. Here I'm just trying to draw a general overarching picture, though, and I'm not going to explain that particular detail. But so far, in all the interesting theories that we have tried to represent this way, we have never had the need for a quartic coupling. Okay, now, what sort of system is this? Eventually, I want to fill the bulk in with some variables. We don't see the difference between this and a world sheet is a world sheet has a variable associated to every point on the world sheet, whereas this diagram only has variables associated with these vertical lines. So it's basically just a literal translation of the Feynman integral into a new picture. So I want to eventually populate this whole strip with a Q of sigma and tau, not just Q sitting on each of these different lines. But before I get there, there is still the question of what kind of a statistical system is it, even if I had such a Q of sigma and tau? And it's pretty clear from the way these lines are lying themselves down that basically at every sigma, any typical sigma, there can be basically be only two situations. There can be not a boundary, or a boundary. So the sort of system we have here is, I'll have to tell you about this Q of sigma and tau, a Q of sigma and tau, and we also have some kind of a two-state system that's living at every sigma that can be in one state or the other. We'll think of it as an Ising spin system, plus or minus one. So the way, I mean, it's purely conventional, but we assigned S equals plus one when there was a boundary, and S equals minus one when there isn't. Then you have to work, depending upon the spin configuration of all these spins, and in order to really make this thing go, you have to discretize this system. According to the spin, the Feynman diagram is completely characterized by the spin configuration of the Ising spin. You look at if you have a string of pluses, there's a boundary there. If you have a string of minuses, there's not a boundary. If there are minuses down here, there's not a boundary. Minuses up here, there's a... So that's the vicinity of one of these lines. There's a row of plus spins surrounded by minus spins. That's what this looks like. A row of plus spins surrounded by minus spins.
How do you know you get the right dynamics when they
When these collide, that's basically where some of the ultraviolet divergences of the theory, of the original field theory, come in.
Yeah. So that's important.
That's certainly going to be important, sure. But that's the next level,
okay.
Which has been analyzed. I mean, I'm not saying it hasn't been analyzed. I mean, I've done it. I have analyzed that to some extent, but that's the next level of explanation of what we're doing. At the moment, think of these as bare diagrams. And in fact, this discretization, which allows me to even think about these spins, is going to take care of that problem, at least in a regulation sense, although it may not do it accurately enough. You see what I'm saying? That we're going to replace the continuous world sheet with a lattice, and then, you know, the rare situation, which is a typical diagram, is to have a bunch of a small number of lined up plus spins, but mostly minus spins. That's the perturbative situation. The extreme non-perturbative situation might be to have a lot of plus spins and minus spins going back and forth. And lots of spin flips. In fact, you can see that because at each place, this is a vertex. That requires a coupling constant, a field theory coupling constant. How is that going to be represented in terms of spin? The coupling constant is going to occur whenever there is a spin flip. If there's a minus to a plus, there's going to be a factor of g. That means that in our statistical system, there's going to be a Boltzmann factor, which has an exponent that is 1 every time there's a spin flip. So if the two spins are alike, the two successive times, I get a factor of g. So right away, the coupling constant is entering this world sheet system as just a term that governs the dynamics of these Ising spins. At strong coupling, you're going to want to have a lot of spin flips. At weak coupling, very few.
Do you count spin flips only in the upward direction?
Yeah, because that's the only place things change.
So this is very asymmetric.
It's extremely asymmetric. That's one of its hallmarks, that it's not isotropic sigma model. The couplings in the time direction are very different from the ones in the space direction. What I put for the world sheet action of the Qs is going to be strongly coupled to the configuration of the spins. The nice thing about it is that the coupling is going to be purely local on the world sheet, which is in accord with the idea that this is eventually going to be some kind of a two-dimensional world sheet quantum fields theory that represents the sum. But it's going to be highly non-conventional. What you just pointed out, it's not isotropic. It's going to be spin variables coupled to continuous field variables. In the old AADS-CFT correspondence, my vision is that these spin variables that are keeping track of the interaction places are going to turn into, in some appropriate coarse-grained sense, the extra dimensions of ADS. But that's a dream. That's a dream more than anything that's shown. And the other nice thing about this is, we could be generic. take, we can start with any field theory that is characterized by cubic couplings and read off the string theory background that is supposed to reproduce the sum of planar diagrams. Okay, any other questions before I actually tell you how to fill out the diagram with variables? What time am I doing? I have 2 minutes. Okay, so now, I've gone through this whole talk basically drawing pictures. And the thing that's left for me to do is to give you a formula behind the picture. Okay, now part of the formula is already here. That is, once everything is said and done, whatever I say about this sum here is going to translate into some configuration of spins here is going to translate into some particular Feynman diagram over there. So we have a formula, but we don't have anything associated with the bulk of the world sheet. So that's what we have to do. The nice thing about that problem is that we can do it with just a single rectangle and then we're done. Because I can divide, you know, every time I see a propagator, I can divide it into a bunch of squares or rectangles. And then if I know how to assign bulk variables to each rectangle, I know how to assign bulk variables to the whole world sheet. Okay, this is simplicity itself. So first of all, this rectangle, I'm doing light cones. So what is this? A rectangle is a propagator. A propagator propagates from some time zero to some final time. This is light cone x plus. And it carries some momentum, some transverse momentum. Now, in our notation, let me call this q1 and q2, a propagator is going to have one of these dual momenta on its left and another dual momentum on its right. So the momentum carried by this propagator is going to be the difference of these two q's. Okay? And the propagator itself is just the factor e to the minus t over 2p plus q1 minus q2 squared. What I want to do is to write this as a path integral of a target space variable q of sigma and tau over a rectangular light cone world sheet. Now, the information of momentum is specified here and here. And also the p plus momentum is by the shape of the, and the x plus is by the shape. So all the target space information is there. I just have to have a give you an action that reproduces this formula. Now this formula is not something that, I mean, it's something that everyone has seen before, except with a change of notation. Let me rewrite it this way. Let me call t a mass, and let me call p plus a time, and let me call the difference of q's a difference of x's. Now everyone has seen this before, right? What is it? It's the particle propagator for a non-relativistic particle. We know what its path history is, because Feynman taught us how to do that. You integrate over x of t from x of 0 equals t1, or, well, let's see. I should call this t1 minus t2. You integrate over x of t, functionally integrate over all xt with conditions that x of t1 is equal to x1, and x of t2 is equal to x2. And you put in an e to the minus integral dt from t1 to t2. Of m x dot squared over 2. Now there's a little factor of, there's a prefactor that comes along with this, the measure factor that comes along with this integration. In fact, this should actually be normalized so that it's a, there should be a prefactor here if we were talking about the true Feynman propagator. But we don't really want that factor here, we just want 1 here. So what do we have to do? We have to just do a little translation. The mass is going to be the time. So we're going to imagine this thing analogous to a line that goes straight across the diagram from q1 to q2. We do a functional integral over all q's of sigma, and I've just looked at one time slice, let's say tau. We integrate over, for fixed tau, we integrate over all q of sigma that start at q1 and end at q2. The time length, the time interval length is p plus, so it goes down here like that does there. The time dt goes here. So we get immediately a formula for e to the minus dt. So let's see, we're trying to rush to finish, and I'm already 4 minutes over.
You can have more.
Yeah, but these things are, people's eyes start to glaze over. So I don't want to take too much time. I mean, I hope that the gaps that I'm leaving will be filled in discussion sections, because I hope to get people excited about thinking about this way of looking at the planar graphs. Because just two people in the whole universe working on this problem is too small. Well, that's what I'm
talking
about.
The whole universe.
Okay, so there's part of the answer. I do this independently of every time slice. So I'm integrating over all q's of sigma and tau. I have Dirichlet boundary conditions. Q at one end is q1, q at the other end is q2. I could write that here, but let me just say that in words. And the only thing I don't have is that this is going to accumulate a lot of measure factors. And as in all topological style theories that have a lot of redundant bulk variables, we need to have fermionic ghosts to cancel, precisely to cancel all of those determinant factors. So this is an identity. Oops. Here's the. This is an identity that's been derived in Feynman and Hibbs, with the possible exception of the ghosts. Okay, so in this complicated diagram that I wrote down over here, which I've erased, let me just take a simple diagram, just a self-energy diagram. I get the bulk variables in the whole sheet just by gluing together 4 rectangles with different shapes. Along this line, everything's continuous where a line doesn't intervene. Along this line, I require that there be a common value of q all up and down the line, and that value of q is integrated over. The ghosts...
How do you define these lines in the spin language?
So in the spin language, now we have some choices to make. I mean, so far I've just sort of kept this thing very qualitative. You have to represent, so let's discretize a line. So I've got a bunch of q's here that a priori are uncorrelated. I have to have a delta function that sets q1 to q2, q2 to q3, q3 to q4, all down the line. So very formally, what I want is the product all the way up the line of a bunch of delta functions. Okay, I want that every time, I define a link of the boundary as coupling two. So every time I have two plus spins in a row, which is one plus s prime over four, I guess, I have, for those two links along the row, I have a delta function. Now, this is obviously a rather singular distribution. It's local, but it's singular. And also, I don't want it to be there when I don't have two spins aligned in a row. So that's why I raise it to that power. That's rather a singular operation. So, well, we've done a number of different ways, tried to handle this in a number of different ways. The simplest minded is just to write a Gaussian approximation to the delta function. With an appropriate factor out here to make sure it's normalized to a delta function when epsilon goes to zero. Then this looks like the lattice version of Q dot. So you have, and this is multiplied by one plus s prime over four. So you have a coupling, this is a highly non-trivial system, a coupling of the Ising spin system to the bosonic variables of that type, quadratic in the bosonic variables, but also quadratic in the spin system. And eventually you have to take epsilon to zero because these are supposed to be real delta functions. We're just approximating them by a Gaussian. Now notice, and this is probably where I should stop, just to kind of end with a tantalizing suggestion. Notice that the process of summing over these rows of plus spins over these boundaries on which Q is fixed, at least in this way of thinking about it, restores a Q dot squared. So if I take this action, which has no interaction, no lines at all, together with this, I have a dynamical world sheet action. Now if I just look at the Q part of it, that looks like this. It has the 1/2 Q prime squared. And now, if I sort of boldly take a continuum version of this, I get a Q dot squared times, well, okay, I don't know exactly what a continuum version of an Ising spin system is. And we have some rough ideas that it's something, but let me just sort of leave it still like that. I have some kind of a dynamical quantity multiplying Q dot squared. So I want to compare that to what you get on light cone ADS, which is this. Let's see, now I like this phi variable. The z is basically e to the minus phi. I may have that wrong. I normally think of phi going to infinity as being t goes to infinity, so I think if that's the if the boundary is at plus phi equals plus infinity, what goes here is minus e to the minus 2 phi. This is like the inverse string tension. See, I've gone to a target space dual variables. Usually we think of the light cone spin in terms of x dot squared plus t zero squared x prime squared. But these q's are t dual to the x's, and it becomes the x dot becomes a q prime, and the x prime becomes a q dot. But what happens if you take the that's what we get when we do the when we do light cone ADS, when we t dual it, it becomes this. So the rough correspondence here is that in ADS there is a dynamical string tension governed by how deep you are into ADS. In this system that you read off, and this spin system is just what is characterizing where the interactions are taking place, you read off an effective Q dot squared with a dynamical string tension or inverse string tension that's given by that.
Where is phi prime?
Phi prime.
Phi itself.
Where is phi? Well, I mean, oh, in this, there's more. We're just focusing on the coordinates. Yeah, the e to the, I forget, well, we did this together. I mean, I forget, the e to the phi and e to the minus phi or something. I forget exactly what the structure was. But there's the kinetic term for the phi. The kinetic term for the spins is, so to speak, well, it depends on what you call it. It's an anisotropic system, but it's basically the coupling constant that measures the importance of the different spin configurations.
There's no spatial derivative.
Not initially, although by the time you really map out how to describe, see, there's a microscopic coupling of the spatial location of the spins with the lines themselves, which are correlated by the whole functional integral. So there's an implicit crosstalk between different sigmas of the spins, but it's induced. So if you have an effective world sheet action, you would certainly generate both a phi dot squared term and a phi prime squared term. Okay, I think I've taken enough of your time. I'll stop for questions, and then hopefully there will be many, many discussions next week.
Identity.
Which identity?
The one e to the minus capital E. I mean, I don't understand the integral in dt. Suppose that you discretize in dt, then you have a product, and you have n, product n times of the Feynman formula.
Right.
So you will get an e to the minus n, not e to the minus t over 2t.
No, you get e to the minus n is. Well,
this formula is simplifying, right? I mean, as it is, it doesn't make any
the
sense.
The dt.
We don't have
it at all. Yeah.
Because it's continuous.
Right, no, but put it in, do it the way Feynman did it. Put it on a.
It's not a question of Feynman, it's an integral in dt that doesn't make any sense.
No, this is just a classical result. This is a classical result.
For
determinants are canceled, that's the point.
No, it's not a question of the.
No, he's worried about something much more lower level than that.
No,
he's worried about this dt.
Because you have a
cubic
structure of two variables.
No, wait, Massimo. I break t up into n times dt.
Mm-hmm. And you just get a piece from each
one. Dt is my lattice spacing in time. I have n time slices. So the whole t is made up of many, many little dts.
And for
each time slice, see, I have to have one of these integrals for each, an independent integral for each time slice. So when I add them all up, I'll have only one of these for each time slice, and then when I add them all up, I get the integral over t.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, that's right. I mean, you can get the exponent by just solving the classical equations of motion and completing the square. You want to do that exercise? It's just q double prime equals zero. So q is equal to a sigma plus b, and you match a and b to the Dirichlet conditions on either side. Different at each time, yeah.
But so that will work for any scalar phi cube theory. How do you distinguish between the theory?
Well, there's more structure. There's more world sheet structure. Well, you know, I've written many papers on these things.
Did you try to apply to this problem of a semi-L'Hopital, or
any calculate this? Oh, well, that involves solving. To solve all the planar diagrams, I have to sum the whole sum.
But is there hope that this problem is more able to do some planar diagrams in a simpler way?
No, what? The Zaremba stuff, I think, is just an indication, nothing more.
Yeah. What?
Just
a hint. Where do you view this as going? I mean, is it going in the direction of a different way of summing planar diagrams, or?
That's precisely what it is.
Yeah. Well, but
it's summing planar diagrams by an analog system.
Right.
We construct a world sheet system that does the sum for us.
Right.
So in principle, I could put it on a computer.
Right. It will be simpler than the original. So.
Okay. I think we should thank Charles again for the talk, and then.
I have the question about